Iceland is a beautiful and dangerous place, even deadly place, for tourists and other people who go there to hike and camp and find themselves lost and in trouble. For example, there's these guys who thought it would be a great idea to jump out on one of these patches of ice and have a picnic. And as they were having their picnic, that piece of ice began floating further and further away from the other pieces of ice until they found themselves in the middle of the water and no way out of it, and they had to come get, somebody had to come rescue them and save them. And then there's a story from 2012 about a tour buses in Iceland will take just, you know, 40, 50 people, just these buses full of hikers. They'll take them to some of the remote locations. And in this instance, they took, you know, a whole busload of hikers to a canyon. It's a volcanic formed canyon there in Iceland. And they get there early in the morning and they set them free to just go hike through the canyon during the day. And so everyone went out hiking through the day. And then as the sun was setting, they all returned back to the bus. And the bus driver just diligently counted everyone to make sure they were all there. Only when he finished counting, he came up one short. Someone was missing. And the sun is setting and it's dark. It gets dark fast and it gets very dark. And he tells everybody, someone's missing. And they know, because I guess they have descriptions, they have of what everybody was wearing, so they know what she was wearing. And he begins to tell everybody, we need to go search. So they call the authorities, and everyone gets off the bus, and they get their flashlights and gear, and they get ready to go out and search for this woman who was missing. And they all have a description of everything she was wearing that day. And the only problem was, the woman they were searching for had been with them the whole time. She was on the bus. And it's this comedy of errors that led to this happening, but the driver miscounted, first of all, and thought he was missing somebody, but he wasn't. And then secondly, the woman had come back a little early, and she had changed her clothes. And so she's wearing completely different clothes from the dark hiking gear she'd been wearing to this light outfit she's wearing. And so when the bus driver said, here's the person, it's a woman, she's 5'2", and she's Asian, and she's wearing this dark outfit, no one noticed because she was standing there, but she wasn't wearing the same clothes anymore. And I don't know how they didn't, you know, here's her name. I don't know, but no one recognized. Here she is. They all, in the excitement of that moment and in the adrenaline of that moment, they all, we've got to go find this woman, including the woman herself. They set out hiking. And it wasn't until 3:00 in the morning when suddenly somehow it dawned on the woman that she was searching for herself. And that all along, she had thought she had been in, but she had been out. She had been left outside. And it's a true story, and it's hard to believe, but it's true. And it's hard to believe because we've gotten so good at recognizing who's in and who's out, haven't we? Well, think about it. It starts in school. You know, it's usually based on what someone looks like or is wearing or talks like and how they act. We're very good at figuring out who's in and who's out. And as adults, we don't even notice anymore. We kind of automatically do it. You walk into a room and you assess, you know, who's in and who's out and of what. So, you know, you see a picture of this guy here, and it's obvious this guy is not in the boardroom, but if you're going to a Grateful Dead concert, he's as in gets, right? But, you know, then you take this next group of people, they know, they don't fit in a Grateful Dead concert, except backstage maybe as the guy's counting the money. These are business people, right? They fit in a company somewhere. It's obvious you look at them, they fit there. And then this next group of guys, you know whether you fit in with these guys or not. It's obvious from the moment you walk into the theater, I'm not like them. Have you ever thought you were in and then realized you were out of some group? Maybe a group of friends, maybe a group at work. You thought you were in, you thought you were part of this thing, and then you realize maybe I'm not, maybe I'm actually out. Or have you ever seen someone who's trying desperately hard to be in, but they really weren't in? Like politicians do this every election cycle, right? They'll travel around the places and try to appear like they're in each place they go, say whatever they have to say in order to appear in, but you know they're not in. It's not always easy, though, to tell who's in and who's out, or whether you're in or out. And last week we said that Jesus entered the world, and it was the genesis of a new creation. And this morning, the question I want us to wrestle with is, are you in or are you out of that new creation? And how do you get in? And what does it mean to be in? And in John's gospel, he illustrates the surprising answers to these questions with the stories of two people, a man named Nicodemus and a nameless Samaritan woman. And this morning, I want to start with Nicodemus' story. It's from John chapter 3. You can turn there if you like. Follow along in the notes in our app or on the screen. We'll show the different scriptures. But I want to start with Nicodemus. And if everything goes according to the plan, Nicodemus will be here next week. No, we're not doing a seance, but if everything goes according to plan, Nicodemus will be visiting next Sunday, and we'll get to hear from him firsthand. It'll be me, in case you haven't figured that out yet. But we'll get to hear from Nicodemus firsthand what exactly happened with him and Jesus. What was going on in his mind and in his heart and in his life as he wrestled with who Jesus was and whether to believe him or not. And it's such a great time to bring friends and invite friends and people to come. People who themselves are wrestling with, what should I really think about Jesus? I hear people talk about him, especially this time of year. But who is Jesus really? It's a great time to bring friends. So Nicodemus was a Pharisee. And around the time of Jesus, there were several thousand Pharisees. And they were admired and looked up to by the Jewish people. They weren't like the elite upper class. Some of you know the name the Sadducees. The Sadducees controlled the temple. They were like the elite upper class, and they're the ones who kind of bought in with the Roman occupiers, and they were in favor of just accommodating and assimilating with the Roman leaders so that everything went well and smoothly, and it usually did for the Sadducees. They lined their pockets and they did well. Well, the Pharisees were against that. They believed that Israel was supposed to be God's people and they should follow God's laws and not mix and follow with these other nations and their gods and their ways. So they hated the occupation and they hated the oppression because they believed Israel should be following God's laws. And if you wanted to know anything about God's ways or who God was and what God was like, you went and talked with one of the Pharisees. They were the teachers, the ones who took God's law seriously and would help you understand who God is. And Nicodemus wasn't just a Pharisee. He was a leader among the Pharisees, which means that Nicodemus would have been the kind of guy who studied God's word diligently, more diligently than you or I could even imagine. It would mean that he would have prayed constantly. He would have fasted regularly, and he would have given to help the poor all the time. And at one point in the conversation, Jesus even refers to Nicodemus as the teacher of Israel. Not just a teacher of Israel, but the teacher of Israel. Nicodemus is an important person. Everyone knew who Nicodemus was. Everyone knew that Nicodemus was on the bus. Nicodemus was not the kind of guy who you'd miss counting on the bus. You knew if there was anybody who was an insider with God, it's Nicodemus. Because if not Nicodemus, then nobody. Nobody would be in with God. And Nicodemus came to talk to Jesus after dark one night when the sun was down and the cover of darkness. Nicodemus came to see Jesus out of the sight of all the people. He and the other Pharisees were curious about Jesus. And he wanted to know who they were dealing with. Who is this Jesus? Is he in with them or is he out? And so Nicodemus starts the conversation with compliments, saying, Rabbi, teacher, we know you're a teacher come from God because no one can do the signs you are doing unless God is with them. Do you recognize what Nicodemus is doing when he says that? He's saying, Jesus, it seems obvious to us that you are in. It seems obvious you're in. But you know how sometimes someone says something to you nice and then you know there's a but coming at the end? Like Christina all the time, honey, I think you're wonderful and amazing and handsome and smart. And I just know there's a but. And then the list of things I failed to do or whatever. You just know. So he starts this way, you know, Rabbi, we know you're a teacher. And this is what he's saying. He's saying, Jesus, it looks to me as though you might be in from based on everything I see you doing, but we're not sure, and I'm here to determine whether you're in or out. But what Jesus does, he doesn't let Nicodemus get to the but about whether or not Jesus is in or out. Jesus looks Nicodemus in the face and says this to him. He says, Nicodemus, here's the absolute truth. You, Nicodemus, you will never see God's kingdom unless you're reborn from above. It's like, whoa, wait, what? Nicodemus' mind is now spinning because suddenly he's not evaluating Jesus. Jesus is evaluating him. Jesus has flipped the tables on him and he's telling Nicodemus that he's out. And you might as well have told Nicodemus he was a fish and not a man. because he has no way of processing what Jesus is saying to him. Imagine if someone came up to you and told you that you are not the person you thought you were. What would you do with that? You're not who you think you are. You're not what you think you are. You're actually, you were born in this other country and adopted by your parents, and your name's really this. And what would you do? What would that do to your world? Imagine how that would shake you and rock you. Jesus is telling Nicodemus everything he believed about who he was, he has to see it all different. Nicodemus doesn't get this. That of course he's in. Of course he's in with God's kingdom, which is, you know, this common phrase. When you talk about the kingdom of God, it's the way, one of the ways they would talk about this new creation that God is bringing. God's bringing his kingdom into this world, new creation. And of course he's in. He's a Jew. He's a devout practicer of God's laws. He's an enforcer of God's laws. How can he not be in God's kingdom? How could he not be part of God's new creation? It's all he wanted was to be part of God's creation, he thought. I want you to step back with me because it's easy sometimes when we read these stories to kind of separate ourselves from them and not realize how they connect to us and how they apply to us. The truth is most people think the way Nicodemus does here. Most people you know think that being in with God, however they want to define that, seems in most people's mind to always depend on either where you were born and or how you behave. It always comes down to those two things. If you were to leave the United States and go most places in the world, they would tell you that you're a Christian or a Jew or a Muslim or anything else based on where you were born. Oh, you're from America, you're a Christian. Oh, you're from Israel, you're a Jew. Oh, you're from the Middle East, you're Muslim. It's based on where you're born for most people in the world. In our culture, we don't think that way anymore. We think differently. We've replaced that idea with this common sense ethic that tells us you're in with God as long as you do enough good and don't do too much bad. That's how most people you know think. Either one of those two ways. It's either where you were born or how you behave or some combination. So we're not far from Nicodemus. We're very much like Nicodemus. Our cultures both have a completely wrong idea of how someone enters this new creation. Completely wrong idea. And Jesus says, here's the truth. You will never enter this new creation. You'll never see God's kingdom unless you are reborn from above. And here's what Jesus is saying. He's saying God has to give birth to you all over again. Just like you were born into this world through the actions of your parents, you must be born into this new creation by the actions of God. You don't get there by your heritage or your traditions or your behavior. After all, what does a baby do to enter the world? Nothing. It's all done to the baby. They have nothing to do with their own existence coming into this world. What can it do? A baby can't believe something or achieve something in order to pass from one into existence here in the world. It takes the actions of the parents and the mother. And then Jesus says this odd thing to help us understand it. He says, John 3:8, the wind blows where it wishes and you hear its sound, but you do not know where it comes from or where it goes. So it is with everyone who is born of the Spirit. And what Jesus is telling Nicodemus and telling us is that in order to enter into this new creation that God has started, to truly be part of God's people, God's children, in God's kingdom, requires that God conceive and birth us all over again in the Spirit. Which means that nothing that's happened before matters. All that matters is what happens from the moment God conceives and gives us new birth. Nothing, you don't bring any, how many babies show up with something in their hands? Right? Have you ever seen a baby show up like they've already got their PlayStation controller ready to go? No, naked I came into this world with nothing. Right? You enter into God's kingdom with nothing. God births you into this kingdom. That's what he's telling us. And this threatens everything Nicodemus had ever achieved or taught or thought for that matter. It meant being Jewish was no longer the entry point. Yearly sacrifices, fastidious law keeping, these were not the way in. The only way into this new creation was the same way you got into the present creation. You need to be born into it. And Nicodemus shakes his head. How can this be? This is impossible. This can't be true. And Jesus' answer essentially is this. He says, this new birth will only happen. The only way this can be is when you observe me and see what I'm about to do. As I am lifted up above this world and crucified and rise from the dead, if you believe in me, you'll find this life of the age to come, this new life, this life of the new creation, eternal life. So this ultimate insider comes to Jesus in the darkness of night and discovers he's actually an outsider. And between this story of Nicodemus and then the one about the woman at the well is John's explanation of how we come to be born into this new creation and what our part is in the whole thing. And it's some of the most famous verses you've ever read. You've probably read them a million times. So that means there's a danger here that you might just zone out as we read them. Don't zone out. Focus in and pay attention to God's act of love here. John 3:16 says, "For God so loved the world that he gave his only son. And whoever believes in him will not perish, but they'll have the life of the age to come, the life of the new creation, eternal life. Because God did not send his son into the world to condemn the world, but in order that the world might be saved through him. And whoever believes in him is not condemned, but whoever does not believe is condemned already because he's not believed in the name of the one and only Son of God." You're in because God, our Father, has loved you. He's loved you immensely by giving his Son for you, his one and only Son, to be born into this world and die at our hands. You're in because God gives birth to you anew from above through Jesus. You're in because of Jesus. That's the only way this new birth is possible that Jesus is talking about. You're in because Jesus passes through death and into life, making this new birth possible into this new creation. Jesus does that and brings it to us. Jesus came to save the world. John makes it clear, first of all, he entered the world for everyone, not just some people, not just those who were born Jews, not just those who behaved well. Jesus came into the world for everyone. God's desire is that everyone be saved. So why isn't everyone saved? Because after God gives us Jesus and Jesus does everything necessary for us to be born again into this new creation, it's up to you and I to respond. Imagine you're a hiker in Iceland and the sun sets and it's pitch black. And the fog and the clouds are covering the stars so you can't see anything and you have no flashlight. And you are trapped out there in the cavern, in this volcanic cavern, and you've got nothing. Imagine you are actually out there lost. And you hear searchers and then you see a light, you see a flashlight. What do you do? What do you do? Do you call out to that person? Do you move toward that light? Or do you scurry away deeper into the darkness, avoiding it? Because you're ashamed. Ashamed of what you've done, ashamed that you got lost, ashamed to be found in this position. So you run back into the darkness. You try to avoid the light. Is that what you do? Would you really rather die than be found? And this is the judgment, John says, John 3:19. This is the judgment. This is what's happening right now. The light has come into the world and people love the darkness rather than the light because their works were evil. For everyone who does wicked things hates the light and does not come to the light, lest his works should be exposed. But whoever does what is true comes to the light so that it may be clearly seen that his works have been carried out in God. Dallas Willard is just a phenomenal Christian author. Read anything he's written. I encourage you. Dallas Willard writes about a 2.5-year-old girl who was in her backyard with her grandmother one day. And while the grandmother was sitting in a chair, she was kind of looking the other way, reading a book. And the little 2.5-year-old girl was making chocolate, warm chocolate, out of mud and having just a ton of fun. And her grandmother finally turned around and realized what she was doing and saw the mess that she had made of herself and everything else. And she's like, oh my goodness. And the little girl's name was Larissa. Larissa, please, no more making warm chocolate anymore. Just please. She cleans her up and gets her all set. And then she turns her chair so she can watch Larissa. and tells her, no more making warm chocolate. Then the grandmother starts to read her book, keeping a watch out of the corner of her eye. The little girl starts to pick up the mud again and go through her routine of making the chocolate. Only as she's doing it, she says, okay, don't look at me, Nana. Don't look at me. And Nana, of course, being like every other grandmother, goes along with it, you know, okay, fine, and doesn't look at her. And then as she's making these chocolate pies, she just keeps repeating over again, don't look at me, Nana. Don't look at me, Nana. And Willard writes, thus the tender soul of a little child shows us how necessary it is for us that we be unobserved in our wrong. Anytime and every time we choose to do wrong or to withhold doing right, we choose hiddenness at the same time, don't we? And it may be, John Ortberg writes this, it may be that out of all the prayers that are ever spoken, the most common one, the quietest one, the one that we least acknowledge ever making is simply this. Don't look at me, God. Don't look at me, God. Don't look at me, God. He said it was the first prayer spoken after the fall. God comes into the garden looking for Adam and Eve, and what do they say? God says, where are you? And Adam replies, I heard you in the garden, and I was afraid, so I hid myself. Don't look at me, God. What does it mean to love the darkness and hide in the darkness? I think what John is showing us is that there's two pieces to this. Those who love the darkness, the example of that is Nicodemus. It's not just they're heinous criminals, it's that they're like Nicodemus in that they'd rather choose the reality they've fabricated for themselves and the lies they're living in than the reality of who God is and the reality of their sin. I think that's what John's trying to tell us, that we'd rather live for the world we've created, and I prefer being my own God versus having God be my God. I'd rather hide from the reality than be exposed to it. Nicodemus wasn't a murderer, but he loved the darkness because it kept him from being exposed to someone who trusted himself more than he trusted God. And for right now, for this moment in his life, because Nicodemus is going to change later on, but for this moment in his life, he chooses to hold on to the lie that he's in with God because of his nationality and because of his status and because of his behavior. That works for him. It's an identity he has put together over years of existence on this planet. And when Jesus shakes it, and shines a light into it that it's not true, he's got a decision to make. Am I going to move toward this light, even though it's dismantling me, or am I going to scurry away back into the darkness? And he scurries away that night. He scurries back into the darkness and walks away, choosing the darkness over the light that night, choosing to live a lie over facing the truth, choosing the God he'd created for himself over Jesus. That's what it means to love the darkness, to love the lies you've created and I've created about who we are and what we are, and not allow that light to shine into us and expose us. So what does it mean then to love the light and come into the light? John says that those who come into light are the ones who do the truth, which is such a really odd way of saying it. But I think the example of the Samaritan woman clears it up. Just like Nicodemus is the example he gives of what it means to love the darkness, the Samaritan woman is the example of what it means to love the light, to do the truth, to embrace the truth about oneself and who Jesus is, even though that means being exposed for our sinfulness and our shame. So do you remember the story of the woman at the well? If Nicodemus was the epitome of what it means to be in, the woman at the well was the epitome of what it means to be out. She had at least three strikes against her. The first one is that she was a woman. And in that culture, that was a strike against you. That meant you were someone who was never really going to be close to God. So that was strike number one. The second one is that she's a Samaritan. And to the Jews, the Samaritans were dogs. The Samaritans, they believed in God. They believed in the first five books of our Old Testament. And that was it. They clung to that. They believed you should worship God in this particular mountain, not in Jerusalem. And to the Jews, the Samaritans were dogs who had just blended God with other things. And so that was another strike against her while she was out. And lastly, she was not a very moral person. She had gone through five husbands one way or another. And she was shacking up with some guy at the time who was not her husband, which I know today is more acceptable generally to our world, but certainly then would have been less acceptable to anybody who considered themselves in with God. And that's probably why she's alone when she comes to the well. But notice when she comes to the well, it's in the middle of the day and in the bright, burning sunshine. Tell me you see the difference, the contrast between her and Nicodemus, who comes in the darkness. She comes in the bright, burning sunshine of the middle of the day. And Jesus speaks to her first this time, and he asks her for a drink of water. She has a bucket. He doesn't. He has no way to reach down into this 100-foot deep well and get the water. And she looks at him and says, basically, what are you, crazy? I'm a Samaritan woman. No self-respecting Jew is ever going to drink from a cup that a Samaritan drinks from, because right away that would make you unclean. And certainly you're not going to drink from a cup that a Samaritan woman drinks from. That would make you probably doubly unclean. So she's like, Jesus, you're nuts. And Jesus doesn't bother with her question about whether he really wants a drink from her. Instead, he cuts to the heart of the matter, why he had come to see her, because he came to see her so that we could hear this, so that we could hear what Jesus told her. So listen to what Jesus wanted you to hear. John 4:10, he says, if you knew the gift of God and who it is saying to you, give me a drink, you would have asked him and he would have given you living water, moving water. He goes on a little bit later and says, everyone who drinks of this water will be thirsty again. Everyone who drinks the water of this world that you were born into, you're going to get thirsty again later. But whoever drinks the water that I will give them will never be thirsty again. The water I will give him will become in him a spring of water welling up to what? The life of the new creation, eternal life. And she hears that, and she does what many of us do. When Jesus talks in these incredible terms about receiving life of a new creation inside of us, living water that will never thirst again, she deflects it with humor and says, oh, you know, please give me this water, Jesus, because then I don't have to keep coming back here every day and I don't have to keep drinking. It would make my life so much easier, Jesus, if you would give me this. And it's funny, not ha-ha funny, but sad funny, how we still do the same thing with Jesus, with God and what he's offered us. We treat it as something that we try to grab hold of just to help us get through our day. I need Jesus just to help me get through today. I just love Jesus because he's always just there with me to help me get through my day. Can I say something just very crassly to you? Jesus is not here to help you get through your day. I know that sounds cruel, and it's not that Jesus doesn't care about you. That's not what I'm saying. I'm saying what Jesus has for you is so much better and so much bigger and so much wider than getting through your day. What Jesus has for you is living out a new creation, is being completely transformed and born again into an entirely new existence, an existence where you're not just trying to survive and keep your head above water because you're working crazy hours and trying to figure out when you're going to shop for your kids and when you're going to be able to cook and when you're going to get the house clean because people are going to come over and you know they're going to be judging you for the way your house is. What Jesus has for you is so much more than just, oh, he'll help you get through that. What he has for us is everything we need to bring about a new creation so that the people who come into your home over these next couple weeks, or the homes you go into over these next 2 weeks, that you will walk in there and bring a new life with you, a living water with you. What have you got to drink here? Really? That's funny you should ask. Let me tell you. That's what Jesus has for us. That's what he has for us. So now watch what Jesus does to her as he's about to shine the spotlight on her. And let's see how she reacts. Will she hold on to the lies she's created about herself to survive, leaning on her tradition and where she comes from? Or will she cling to the sin that she's grown comfortable with, this life she's grown comfortable with? Or will she embrace the light? This is what Jesus does. He takes out a big old spotlight and says, why don't you go get your husband? Bring him. And she, now she's not joking anymore. She kind of looks down. Well, I don't have a husband. And Jesus says, That's true. That's true. I know it's true because I know you've had five husbands. And the man that you are having right now is not your husband. And she squirms. And then she does something similar to Nicodemus. She acknowledges who Jesus is. She says, I can see that you're a prophet. I can see that you appear to be in with God. I recognize that. And there's probably more to their conversation as he revealed the things about her life, but she sees it. I see that you're in with God. And then she tries to deflect that conversation now to this bigger argument that the Samaritans had with the Jews. Okay, the Samaritans say that to be in with God, you come to this mountain and worship, that this is the place where you are in with God. And the Jews say that to be in with God, you go to Jerusalem and you worship in the temple. So tell me which one it is. And I don't think she's just deflecting. I think she's really saying, which is it? Which is it? How am I supposed to be in with God? What does it mean to be in with God? Worship here or worship there? And then Jesus says to her, the hour is coming and is now here when true worshipers will worship the Father in spirit and truth. But the Father is seeking such people to worship him. God is spirit, and those who worship him must worship in spirit and truth. Do you think spirit and truth are important if Jesus says them twice? And the woman says, I know that the Messiah is coming, and when he comes, he's going to tell us all these things. You can almost hear a question in her voice. You, him? And Jesus says, I who speak to you am he, which is so rare. Jesus doesn't do that. But with this woman, he does. You know why? Because when he shined the light, she didn't scurry away back to her darkness. She didn't run away from truth. She embraced the light. She did the truth. She went into the truth. And immediately, what does God do in response? He reveals himself. And you see him. And you know him. God is actively seeking you, seeking people who will step into his light and embrace him in spirit and in truth. Meaning, with total sincerity, in the depth of your being, and with total reality about who we are and who he is. Not making God the way we want him to be. Not hiding behind a reality we fabricated. But embracing the truth, doing the truth. And that's exactly what this woman does. She gets up and she runs back to the village. And she tells everyone there, come see a man who told me everything I ever did. Now look, if I found somebody who told me everything I ever did, you better believe I would not bring him here and have you meet him. I would probably want to try and kill him or cut out his tongue or something like that quickly before he meets any of you. What does that say about us? Are we willing to run and embrace and do the truth? We know she leaned into the truth and she embraced the truth. She stepped into the light because she went and told all these people, come see the one who's told me everything I ever did. They knew what she was like, but they probably didn't know everything. No one knows everything, do they? About you. She brings him in to see Jesus. She embraces the truth about who she was. And when the light shined on her, she didn't scurry away. She chose the light. And one weekend, the author, Paul Tripp, had a teenage son. And his teenage son and his son's friend came to him and they said, you know, Dad, I want to spend my time at my friend's house this weekend. Can we do that? And so Paul asked his son's friend, your parents will be there at your house? And his son's friend said, yep, they'll be there, absolutely. And he's like, all right, fine. And he let his son go to spend the weekend with his friend at his friend's house. Sunday rolled around, Sunday afternoon, and he gets a call from his son's friend's mother. And she tells him, look, I just thought I should call you and let you know. Your son's not here. My son just came to me and told me that he had lied to cover for your son and that he told you that your son would be here with us this weekend, but your son's not, and I just thought you should know that. So Paul thanked her and then hung up the phone and then went to his wife. Hey, how would you feel? How would you feel? He is just all kinds of shades of red, ready to murder his son. And he's like, I cannot believe he would do this. He was a good kid. And he's like, I cannot believe he would do this. I cannot believe he would lie to us and drag his friend into it. And his wife said, I think you need to go pray. And he's like, I don't think I can even pray for him right now. And she said, I don't mean pray for him. I think you need to go pray for you. And so he did. He went and he began to just pray. And as he was sitting in his bedroom praying, this is what he writes. He says, I went to my bedroom to pray for God's help. And it hit me that because of his love, God had already begun a work of rescue in my son's life. See, God was the one who pressed in on the conscience of my son's friend. causing him to confess to his mom. And God was the one who gave her the courage to make that difficult call to tell me. And God was the one giving me time to get a hold of myself before my son came home. Now, he says, rather than wanting to rip into my son, I wanted to be part of what this God of grace was doing in this moment of rebellion, this moment of deception and hurt and disappointment. His son got home that evening, and he gave him a few hours to relax, and then he called him into his room, and they sat down together, and he said, "Son, do you ever think about how much God loves you?" And his son said, "Sometimes, yeah." He said, "Do you ever think how much God's grace operates in your everyday life?" And his son looked up at him but didn't talk, like, "Where are we going with this?" And then he asked his son, "Do you know how much God's grace was working in your life even this weekend?" And then his son just asked him, "Who told you?" And this is what, listen to what he said to his son. He said, "You have lived your life in the light. You've made good choices. You've been an easy son to parent, but this weekend you took a step toward the darkness. You can live in the darkness if you want. You can learn to lie and deceive. You can use your friends as your cover. You can step over God's boundaries, or you can determine to live in God's light." And he said, "I'm pleading with you. Don't live in the darkness. Live in the light." And he says, as I turned to walk away, I heard his voice behind me saying, "Dad, don't go." So I turned around and I saw him, and there were just tears in his eyes. And he said, "Dad, I want to live in the light, but it's so hard. Will you help me? If you find yourself in the darkness this morning, whether it's the darkness like Nicodemus' darkness or the darkness that Samaritan woman had been living in, understand this. If you reach out to God, our Father, and instead of praying, "Don't look at me," pray, "Will you help me?" He will come running to you. He will come running to you and shine that light and pull you out of that darkness. And you're in a church of people, filled with people that will help you if you would just move toward this light, this life, and choose this day to love Jesus instead of loving darkness. Would you stand with me? Stand with me and let's bow our heads.